Somewhat more than a century ago, the noted British author and social critic Thomas Carlyle published a series of short essays entitled On Heroes and Hero Worship. The purpose of these articles was a simple one. Carlyle proposed to underscore the unique importance to human civilization of the creative individual. He felt that history cannot be explained simply as a concatenation of impersonal forces. We cannot understand the development of world thought without understanding the contribution of that unique genius, Socrates. Mohammed unleashed a new world religion and a new world power in an area which had been supine and asleep. Shakespeare fashioned the English language into a tool of beauty, great classic form. But before his day, it had been simply another of the popular folk languages of our world. The skein, the fabric of world history, bears indelibly imprinted upon it the mark. Men of genius, of these rare individuals who give to whatever discipline their mind is concerned with new dimension, new direction. I recommend the rereading of Carlyle's essays to you. You'll find them crammed with information. You'll find them a delight as far as its style is concerned. But more important, I think that you will find them a healthy corrective to some of our modern philosophies of life. We live in an age which tends to discount the individual. It is the mass, not the man, that is supremely important. Various economic theories, not the least of them those of the communists, tell us that man is a prisoner of vast economic forces which he can neither mitigate nor control. Man, they picture much like the protagonist of those ancient Greek dramas, who how much he might rail against his fate, could neither change it nor prevent whatever the stars had in store for him. Many philosophies, especially the philosophies of history, those philosophies which originate with Hegel, tell us that man is a sport of the vast forces of life. He neither makes his future nor controls his destiny. Various historic laws of growth and decay, of challenge and response, much similar to those popularized recently by Mr. Arnold Toynbee. These are the forces which govern life, and not the individual will and talents of the individual man. And the nascent science of sociology has made us all aware of the importance which the group plays in the development of civilization. All these things, then, have made us conscious of the group, of the class, of the nation, not of the single, lone man of spirit, man of creativity. Now, I suppose that it is extremely understandable that we have cultivated in our day and age these philosophies of the mass. We live in an age which has seen an explosion of world population. We have been moved, each of us, further and further away from the centers of power and of decision. We live in an age of new science, new technology, and few of us have mastered the intricacies of this new age, of this new thought. Few of us feel wholly competent to make the necessary social and political and economic decisions to meet the future which now faces us. Life has become infinitely more complex. The decisions which we must make have become at the same time infinitely more crucial and final. If we make a mistake, we may have no second chance. It is easy then to see why man has tried to rationalize his feelings of frustration and of insecurity. Certainly it is easier for the ego to feel that we in no way can change our future. For if we feel thus, we can accept whatever defeat and whatever frustration life holds in store. There's only one trouble with all of these theories. They find absolutely no substantiation in life. Carlyle quotes for us chapter and verse of men of rare genius who changed the whole path of human history, the whole direction of the growth of human civilization. We cannot deny these facts, and we cannot deny that common sense tells us that in our own lives we are not marionettes, puppets, dangling at the end of a string, our every action controlled, manipulated by some unseen hand. No, we know that we make our lives, we make our future. Whether we work or are indolent, whether we sacrifice or are selfish, whether we are indifferent to the decisions of politics which face our community, or whether we concern ourselves and are educated about them, these decisions which each of us individually makes, which no man or power makes for us, these decisions mold our future. They mold the future of our families. And to a very great sense, our individual decisions taken in the large mold the future of mankind. Carlyle then speaks a lesson spoken centuries before him in our own Bible. In the book of Deuteronomy, you will find a challenge to man which needs no commentary, only commitment. See, I have set before you, God says, this day, life and the good, death and the evil. Choose life, that ye may live. The power of life, hope, these are in the hands of man, in the hands of the individual man. Our Bible begins not with philosophy. Our Bible does not begin with theology or with law. It begins with history. It begins with biography, with the tales of Abraham and of the patriarchs, of Moses and of Aaron, of Elijah and of the prophets, of that whole generation of men who forged Judaism, who gave life and flesh and a future to what might otherwise have been a pallid and insubstantial doctrine. These are the men whose stamp is imprinted in every act of worship which we sanctify, in every holiday which we celebrate, in every moral value which we gain from our tradition. They gave it to us. They found it in the world. They spoke it to their age. They wrote it in their holy books. We are their heirs. Judaism, like Carlyle, insists on the importance of the creative personality. We differ from Carlyle, however, in this. Carlyle thought only of the men of renown, of unique genius, unique abilities. He spoke in the long line of tradition of men who have drunk deeply from the fountain of Greek philosophy and knowledge, of all those generations of thinkers who have insisted that there are some who must be ruled and some who are fit to rule. He makes a separation in his own mind between the mass, the ordinary, the canaille, and the aristocrat, the noble, the man of unique powers and talents. Judaism is quite other. Judaism is the history of a slave people, of a people from the most humble and ordinary of origins, slaves, serfs, desert nomads. It is the grand and magnificent tale of a people who, despite their origins, were able to find the spiritual grandeur which coursed about them in the world and speak it that all men might hear. Judaism thinks of the greatness in the ordinary man. Carlyle thinks that the ordinary man cannot be great. Judaism speaks that every man having been created in the image of God, that each of us is in his own way potentially but little lower than the angels. Judaism gave the world the gospel of democracy. And Carlyle, despite his insistence on the value of the individual, gave to fascism aid and support. We differ from Carlyle also in this, and perhaps this point of view derives from what I've just said. Reread the book of Carlyle, reread his biographies. You will not find a single woman set down therein. In all the ages of world history, from all of the acts of greatness and of heroism which have been performed, Carlyle could not find a single woman worthy to be set down and inscribed in, on his pages. And the same is strangely true of the biographer of the Greek and Roman world, Plutarch. He gives us some 70 lives in his biography, the lives of 70 of the wisest and most renowned and most heroic and noble of all of Rome and Greece, of all of the ancient world. Not a single woman is worthy to be inscribed on his pages. Open instead the frontispiece of your Bible. Look down its table of contents. You will see that 22 books bear the title of their principal protagonist. Two of these, the Book of Ruth and the Book of Esther, bear the title of women, bear the title of their own heroine. Nor is this a bit of male gallantry. For certainly the beauteous Esther, who was willing to put her life, her security, her position in jeopardy for the sake of her people, is worthy of being entitled. And surely the gentle and gracious Ruth, who personifies and epitomizes all that is loving and loyal and lovely in human character, surely this heroine, too, deserves the honor of her history being titled by her name. The Bible gives us a full portrait gallery of women of strength, of women of character, of heroic women. The Bible did not set apart any class or any sex and say that these are ordinary people, common people, people in which you will not find nobility. It found nobility among the common man. It found nobility among the women of Israel. And as I reread the stories of the noble women in our Bible, I was struck by one fact. These are not women who live in a closed, separate world of recipes and coiffures and dresses and the like. These are women of strength, women of action, women who live in a world not unlike our own, in which they take their place when necessary in the political arena and in the marketplace and in among all the affairs of mankind. These are women of strength. The first story in our Bible is a fable. It is a myth. You know it well, the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. I ask you, who is the stronger willed of the two? Is it not Eve who bedevils her husband to accede to her wish and to sin against God? Is it not she who makes him accomplice to her acts? Turn a few pages more to the story of the first mother in Israel, Sarah, wife of Abraham. Sarah was so strong-willed that she was able to force her husband to drive away from his tent Hagar, his second wife, though our Bible tells us this matter was extremely grievous for him to do. Fortunately, the strength of will exhibited by these mothers of Israel was often put to better use in bedeviling their husbands. Think of Miriam. Think of Miriam, sister of Moses. Think of her on the day when the Jews were about to leave Egypt. The host was assembled. Baggage was packed. The camels were ready to be led into the desert. There was that awful moment of indecision. which always comes before a people actually takes the first step into its future. And here our Bible portrays to us Miriam passing to and fro among the host of Israel, encouraging, giving spirit, giving hope, encouraging the people to march confidently with their God into the desert. When the Jews have successfully crossed the Red Sea, it is Miriam who has chosen to sing the great song of triumphant liberation to God. Think of Deborah, judge of Israel, a matriarch of the tribe of Ephraim. She lived some 100 years or so after the Jews had begun their invasion of Canaan. She lived at a time when the many cities of the Jews in Canaan were surrounded and often attacked by enemy hosts. For 20 years now, the Canaanite king Sisera had attacked first one city and then the next. All Israel was weak, all Israel was wounded, and there was none in Israel, no man in Israel, who was willing to bear arms and dare in open combat the hosts of this bandit king Sisera. It required a woman, the spirit and the will of a woman, to force the Jews to be courageous, to force a certain Barak, general of the tribes of Israel, to summon his host. And only when she had promised Barak that she would go into battle with him, only then did the host of Israel march off and throw off in battle the yoke of 20 years of oppression and of tyranny. Israel owes much to women of strength, women of action. They owe much to a certain prophetess, Huldah. She lived in the early part of the 7th century before the Common Era. She was undoubtedly one of the major forces behind what we know as the Deuteronomic Revolution, a Reformation, which was a reformation of Judaism, which drove out from our midst many of the pagan practices which over the ages had seeped in. A woman, Atalia, albeit not a good woman, was for a time king, queen of all Israel. Israel's women were neither giddy nor flighty nor shy. They're willing in the home, in their communities, to march alongside of their husbands. But fortunately, the women of Israel never forgot that they were, whatever their opportunities in the larger life, they were essentially women, wives, and mothers. When Lemuel, in the last chapter of the book of Proverbs, paints that glorious picture of the Jewish woman which you heard sung this morning, it is not as prophetess, and not as judge, not as warrior that he commends her, but he commends the woman who looks well to the ways of her household. He commends the woman whose children raise up and call her blessed. He commends the mother. He commends the wife. And it is as mothers of Israel, both literally and symbolically, that Sarah, Rachel, and Rebecca are known and beloved to us. And it is as a surrogate mother that really Miriam gains her fame, as she watches over the canoe cradle of the little boy Moses tossing in the Nile, and as she nurses the growing lad Moses in the palace of the Egyptian Pharaoh. And perhaps the woman Hannah, mother of the great judge Samuel, stands and typifies all that is great in these mothers of Israel, and her acts of self-denial and of renunciation for her God and for her son. It is as a mother, the woman of Israel reaches her finest hour. And strangely, it is as a mother, the women of Israel most affect and control the destiny of our people. For it is a mother who makes, in a very real sense, the visions which are her sons or her daughters, the character which is her sons or her daughters, the set of values and of standards which are theirs. She it is in the cradle, the crib, in the early formative stages which Freud has so underscored in importance to us. It is she who makes the molders of the future what they will be. In a very real sense, makes them strong or weak, gives them the visage or the selfishness to make tomorrow a thing of glory or an hour of frustrated despair. And so if we were to write postscript this day to the essays of Mr. Carlyle, we would agree with him that each of us, in a very real sense, within the limits of our common mortality, controls our destiny and molds our future. And we would pray that those women who are blessed with motherhood find in their hearts courage, dedication, understanding, and vision sufficient for their offspring to mold that future of which now we only dream and pray. Amen.